because they told me they would. Conference Committee on House File 829 will come to order. Tonight is the last day of April 2007. And I would very much like to start the conference committee tonight by thanking everybody who has worked so hard on this conference committee. First, I'd like to thank the staff from both the House and the Senate for their work throughout the entire session, and especially in the past week while we have been here trying to put together a good bill for the state of Minnesota. I'd like to actually thank by name Libby, Representative Paymars, Legislative Assistant, Melanie, Representative Paymars, Committee Administrator, Jeff from House Research, Becky from House Research, Gary, the House Fiscal Analyst, Kate, House Majority Research, Dennis, House Republican Research, Patrick, who is Representative Mullery's Committee Administrator. In the Senate, Nikki, my Legislative Assistant, Alice, the Committee Administrator, Sarah, our Committee Page, Ken, our Senate Counsel, we couldn't do it without you, and Chris, our Fiscal Analyst. Megan from Senate Majority Research, Linnea from Senate Republican Research, Regina, Senator Moise, Committee Administrator, Eric, Senator Foley's Committee Administrator, and Kelly, Senator Foley's LA. And let me for sure thank the reviser staff who are going to be working all night to make sure that we have this bill for us in the next few hours when we come back after we get a night's sleep. And I think they won't. And I'd really like to thank all of the members for their hard work and the energy and the insight that they have brought to this committee. We are grateful for all the work that you have done in making this bill. I'd also like to thank Senator Moise and Senator and Representative Mullery, who chaired the policy working group. We also had Representative Lesh and Eastland and Senator Ingebretson, who worked really hard on that policy working group. I'd also like to thank all the departments, the agencies, and the advocates who have been talking to us throughout this entire session about the funding for the various programs that they work for. As many of you know, we received a kind of a funky target. We received it on Saturday, and it was less than both the House and the Senate's original bills. It was very difficult for us to come to the final version of this bill, and there were many compromises that were made on both sides so that we could get this into this final version. While we couldn't fund every program or initiative that we would have liked to, and some we didn't even fund at, you know, what might have been called a reasonable level, I think we have a bill tonight that embodies the priorities of the conference committee and hopefully the rest of the House and the Senate as well. That being said, we will walk through the final bill in a spreadsheet. Our staff will go through that with us, and then members may wish to comment or ask questions. At the end of the meeting, we'll vote on the bill and then send it to the reviser's office. They will prepare the conference committee report, and we will have it for your signature tomorrow. Let's start with a walk. Let's see, anything that Representative Paymar? Nope. Okay. I see lightning out there. Let's start with a walkthrough of the spreadsheet. And Gary, is that you?
Yes.
Okay. Mr. Carter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Many members will start walking through the spreadsheet. Let me just point out a couple items. One is that the spending now is over $2 billion in spending. That includes general fund and special revenue funds, trunk highway funds. That's a very big number. Madam Chair went over the targets. The targets, we are right on target. They were low. There also was a tails target. We are 1,000 below the tails target. And so we'll start out with the, I will just highlight some of the major changes here in the spreadsheet. The first one is the Supreme Court. Basically there I want to first cover civil legal services. There is an increase of $980,000 each year for $1.96 million for the biennium. This is one-time funding because of the tails problem that we had. The total Supreme Court is $90.5 million. Court of Appeals, highlight we kept with the three new judge units, and the total there is $20.386 million. The district courts, I should point out there that there are now seven, the committee is recommending seven new judgeships. Some of the items, the one that went down a little bit is the expansion and the maintaining the drug courts, that's at $4.2 million. We have the mandated services, and we have the total for that is over $500 million. On page two, we're going to go through these first ones fairly rapidly. Tax Court, Uniform Laws Commission, Board of Judicial Standards were basically the same. The only difference in the beginning was the compensation item, and once again, that is at 3% for everyone. The Public Defense Board is the next one. There's two line items there, one for their compensation adjustment and the other one for their caseload increase. That was a little over $8 million. The total there is close to $136 million. Public safety, we'll point out the major differences there. The disaster assistance state match is not funded. The pandemic flu preparation, their staff position for 2 years. That's on line 87. We'll go to the BCA on page 3. The CRIMNET information system that is funded at 5.395, that will fund live scans, and I believe a little more, have them start on their other projects. And we did pick up the governor's tails on that for over $2 million each year. The next one is on line 102, the forensic scientists. Basically, there's 14 to 15 scientists there, plus maybe a little overtime, and that's at $1.92 million for the biennium. Fire marshal, we're the same. We've been the same all along. Same thing with the program in public safety, gambling and alcohol enforcement. Office of Justice programs on page 4. You can see that there's quite a few programs here that are funded. Crime victims reparation increase that stays. That is $500,000. We'll go through this gang strike force. That has always been the same at $2.5 million. Next, we go to victim notification, $910,000. And then the OJP grant program. This was the House position where we had, I believe, 10 grants in there. They are now broken out, or so we funded some of those programs, and the first one being parenting time centers at $400,000. The Child Advocacy Centers at $100,000 for the biennium. The Squad Car Technology at $500,000 each year. And also, it will sunset in fiscal year 11, but there in the next biennium for the first year, there will be $500,000. Aid to families of victims of murder and suicide. This is $200,000 for the biennium. And then the Crime Victim Services increase. This is at $3.4 million. We should point out that there will be tails on this one. Like I said, we had a very tight tails target at $737,000 each year. The next item is the law enforcement and emergency grants. That's on line 147. That is at $2 million for the biennium. Then we have some of the other grant programs, the auto theft, where they're going to pay for the impound fees. That's $150,000 for the biennium. Youth intervention program is $1.5 million for the biennium. The legal advocacy trafficking victims, $300,000. Emergency assistance grants, $200,000. Defibrillators at $100,000. Integrated Domestic Violence Response, $500,000. The ACE program, or the Children at Risk in Ramsey County, at $500,000. And then the Homeless Outreach Program at $300,000. Next program is 9/11 Emergency Services, or ARMOR. Basically, that is the same. That has always been the same in both House and Senate positions. Next, we'll go to page 5, the Post Board on line 181. We have the law enforcement training reimbursement. There was a compromise on this, and this is now at $50,000 each year. Private Detective Board starting at 185 and Human Rights on 191. They basically have been the same, and they're the same, basically. corrections on institutions. What we're doing here is mainly it's the governor's recommendations there, on, except for the compensation, of course. You know, with the annualizing the cost increase in health services, retiree insurance, and the fuel and utility costs. The one difference then coming up is the line 209. This is increasing the theft threshold, and that's the savings projected out to be a little over $1.3 million for this biennium. The one thing is that the checks were left in, and the staff will cover that, I think, later on. The
checks were out.
The checks were out. The other one is the bed impact. There's a small bed impact for some of the bills that we had in there, and that's at $410,000 for the biennium. Page 6 is community corrections. Basically, we're always very similar for, you know, the first programs under community program costs. We did, the House came down on the continuing funding for the conditional release program to $300,000 each year. The changes to Interstate Compact, the Senate came up, that is now $450,000. Risk assessment, that has is now at $700,000 for the biennium. The line IDA, or the line 226, the CCA increase, and then the next line, CPO, DOC services, they have not changed. They are still at the amounts that were recommended. Next on line 229 is probation caseload reduction. This is now at $4 million for the biennium. Line 231, sex offender treatment, is at $1 million. The next item funded is sentencing to serve. That's going to fund those six programs that would have went away if we didn't have funding, at $1.2 million. The increase in short-term offenders, we're above the governor, and that has stayed. It's both in the Senate and the House. It always has been at $5 million for the biennium. The next item after compensation is the offender reentry. This is the Metro Demonstration Project. That is now at $1.6 million for the biennium. Next item is line 240. It's the reentry pilot project for North Minneapolis, deals with employment services. That is at $400,000 for the biennium. The next is on 241, reentry grant program for domestic violence. That is at $400,000 for the biennium. Line 242 is reentry. This productive day, and that is at $300,000. And then the last one on the community services is the mentoring grants for incarcerated parents. And this is at $750,000 for the biennium. Operation support is basically the same except for the compensation adjustments. And on line 7, or page 7, we have sentencing guidelines. And on line 268 is the Senate position was taken, and that is $100,000 in 08 for the ceiling records and collateral consequences studies. Basically,
it's not right anymore.
It's just the. Oh, just the, excuse me, yes, it is just a collateral sanctions, yes. We will change the spreadsheet to reflect that. That's basically it.
Other questions from the committee members on the spreadsheet? A lot of information there in a short amount of time. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On line 236, did we skip that? Under Reentry Services, DOC, is that the only sentence, honey?
236, Madam Chair, Senator Rosen.
Carter.
Yes, that is, excuse me, we did skip that. That is the Department of Corrections reentry program, and what the House and Senate did there is they took out the two Metro grant programs, and I think they are intending to fund Olmstead. It's a grant program. And the other ones we figured would be for the offender reentry for the Metro demonstration.
Other questions on the spreadsheets? Okay, thank you, Mr. Carter. That was.
I have a question, Madam Chair.
Oh, Representative Smith.
Thank you, of Mr. Carter. The other night there was testimony from corrections that the number on that line item pertaining to their compensation adjustment results in 79 layoffs. What line item addresses that issue, and has that changed since then, the dollar amount?
Mr. Carter.
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, no, it has not. And the agreement, I think, that was reached with leadership was that, well, should, a little history, the House had 4.25% compensation adjustment. The Senate had 3.25%. And the we were given, along with the target, a compensation target of 3%. So that has not changed. And
thank you.
Senator Neville.
Madam Chair and Senator, or Representative Smith, it's my understanding, and maybe we could get testimony if I'm wrong, is that this would actually result in about 150 or 60 losses in prison guard staff with the budget that's being proposed here.
Madam Chair.
Representative
Smith. When we get to that point in the discussion, I would like to hear testimony as to the effect of this budget on layoffs and corrections.
Do you want to do that now or when we get to that piece in the article?
It can wait, Madam Chair.
Okay.
Thank you.
If I forget, remind me. All right. Other questions? Then we'll have Mr. Turner start walking through Article 1. Mr. Turner.
Madam Chair, members, much of this will be redundant because Article 1, most of Article 1 reflects the spreadsheet, but there are some riders that that are unique. The first thing I'd like to say is that 3% compensation increase is built into the general appropriations throughout the bill. There will not be compensation riders with one exception, and I'll note that when I get to it. So if we just want to follow along, on page 1, start with the summary of appropriations, summary by fund, down to line 1.15, then more straight boilerplate budget language, definition of the fiscal year, is section 2. We move over. The real appropriations start on page 2. We begin with the Supreme Court with a total appropriation $44.6 million the first year and $45.9 the second. Then we get to, you get down to line 2.7, and this is the only rider that discusses the compensation within the bill. And it has to do with judicial salaries, and it stipulates that the judges get a 3% salary increase in July 1st, 2007 and July 1st, 2008. Then moving down, starting on line 2.12, this is a standard Supreme Court rider that we put in every other year that allows the court to spend money on small unanticipated expenses. For example, visitors or et cetera. Then we move on to the civil legal services rider. We have a total for civil legal, and then we have a rider talking about the base budget that I think Mr. Carter pointed out. The rider from 2.17 to 2.19 stipulates that the $980,000 per year increase is one-time funding. The next rider, legal services to low-income clients and family matters, is another standard rider that we put in every 2 years concerning representation in family law matters. We move on to the Court of Appeals, page 3. It's simply the rider that creates the new three-judge appeals panel. It also appropriates money for additional staff, and it's fairly prescriptive. Three additional judge units, an additional staff attorney, and 2.67 additional full-time law clerks. We move on to the trial courts. The first rider is the new judge units. Creates the seven new judges, three in the first, one in the seventh, one in the ninth, and two in the tenth. The next rider, starting on 3.20, is simply the maintenance of drug courts rider. Then we have the state-mandated services riders that pretty much just follow the spreadsheet. Guardian ad litem services, interpreter services, psychological services, and informa pauperis services. Next three lines are straight appropriation lines for the Tax Court, Uniform Laws Commission, and the Board on Judicial Standards. There is a rider under the Board of Judicial Standards that creates a special investigative and hearing fund, and it stipulates that this appropriation does not cancel. The appropriation level is $125,000 each year. We move on to the public defense. We have one line for public defense with one rider for caseload increase, and we're pretty prescriptive about that, that require them with their $8 million to hire 34 new full-time attorneys and 11 new full-time equivalent support staff. And then at the end of the rider, it says, of this amount, $200,000 each year may be used for transcript costs. Starting on page 4.19 is the public safety summary by fund. Then you get down to the first public safety division, which is emergency management and homeland security. It has one rider under it, and that is the rider concerning the pandemic flu coordinator. It stipulates $75,000 each year for this biennium, but it makes it a one-time appropriation.
Madam Chair, may we ask questions as he goes along?
Yes.
If it's to specify something.
On that specific item, sure.
Madam Chair, thank you.
Smith.
On line 4.17 and 4.18, fiscal analyst then analyzing the $200,000 each year for transcript costs, I heard him say may be used.
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, I misspoke. It will be used.
Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Turner.
Madam Chair, members, then moving on to the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, you have their summary by fund. Their first, then they have three standard riders that we include every other year. The first is a rider appropriating $93,000 each year from the Special Revenue Fund for grants to local officials for cooperative investigation of cross-jurisdictional criminal activity. This special revenue is from the it's part of the $250 DWI reinstatement fee, which is proportioned. I think this is 8% of that fee. The next rider also comes from that fee. That's lab activities for the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension from DWI reinstatement fees and for DWI forensic activity. The next rider also has to do with DWI. It's DWI lab analysis funded through the Trunk Highway Fund, and this is specifically for offenders arrested by the State Patrol. Next page 6, we have the criminal justice information integration. This is basically the live scan fingerprinting units. There's a little bit more money than was requested for live scan. We allow them to prioritize that money. And then we state the base at $2 million each year for 2010 and 2011. Next rider requires the Criminal and Juvenile Justice Information Policy Group to study funding sources other than the general fund for new CRIMNET costs. And then it has a report date of January 15, 2008. The next rider concerns the forensic scientists. It funds approximately 15 scientists. It's $509,000 the first year, $1,411,000 in the second. Line 6.19 to 6.21 read, if the appropriation for either year is insufficient, the appropriation for the other year is available for it. This gives the commissioner the authority to hire all the, use all of the money in the first year, hire them all in the first year. The next rider is Crime Labs and Crime Strike Task Force Working Group. The Commissioner of Public Safety must convene a working group to study and prepare a report on the appropriateness of additional forensic crime laboratories throughout the state. We move on to the Fire Marshal.
Representative Smith.
Does this language affect the discussion that was held earlier in the week relative to the bonding bill amounts? and the potential of a conflict in language, et cetera, Madam Chair.
Representative Paymar.
Chair, Representative Smith, we took that language out so Anoka County can proceed with their forensic lab.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members, moving on to the fire marshal on page 7, line 8. The legislature created a fire service advisory committee. This rider appropriates $9.6 million to the advisory committee. The money is derived from the fire tax that was created when we moved from the general fund to the special revenue fund, the fire marshal, which took place 2 years ago. The next line is just a straight alcohol and gambling enforcement appropriation rider. Then we move into Office of Justice Programs. This is where things will get a bit redundant because Mr. Carter already went through them. We start with the Crime Victim Reparations Program, $500,000 each year, or $250,000 each year is a governor's rec. Emergency assistant grants, $100,000 each year. This was a House position. Then a governor's rec for the gang and drug task forces, $600 the first and $1.9 the second for the gang and drug task forces. That's an increase. That's basically replacing federal dollars that were lost. The gang strike force has traditionally been funded by state money, the drug task forces by federal money. And when we combined them 2 years ago, the federal money has dried up, and so the state is taking responsibility for both task forces. Next line is victim notification system.
Mr. Chair. Representative Polster.
Thank you. Can you tell me, did the money dry up because we merged them, or and they're no longer eligible, or is the money that they used to get no longer in existence?
Madam Chair,
Mr. Turner.
Representative Hillstrom, I don't think it had anything to do with our merger, but you would have to ask the Department of Public Safety to be sure.
So, Mr. Turner, were these burn grants? Do you know?
Yes.
Representative Hillstrom, the burn grants that the federal government has given Minnesota have been getting smaller and smaller and smaller every year, and I think in their problems in getting their budget bills passed, that money has just been, I mean, it may come, it may not come, but if it comes, it's probably smaller than what we've ever had. So. Mr. Turner.
Madam Chair, members, then moving on, we have another governor's recommendation that the House and Senate concur with on the victim notification system, $455,000 each year. Then we have a House provision on supervised parenting grants, $200,000 each year to provide supervised parenting time services to children in Minnesota. There's an evaluation component required of the commissioner. It's a one-time appropriation. Another House position, Child Advocacy Center grants, $50,000 each year. Again, a one-time appropriation. We have move on to the squad car cameras, $500,000 each year for law enforcement agencies to make squad car camera technology upgrades or acquisitions. The writer states that of the amount, $250,000 each year for the first 2 years is for a grant to the city of Minneapolis. To be eligible for an acquisition grant, a law enforcement agency must provide a 25% match. No match is required for an upgrade.
Madam Chair.
Senator Foley.
Madam Chair and Mr. Turner, on those grants, acquisition and so forth, the Brooklyn Park had some where they purchased the cameras, and now they're wearing out or obsolete, and some of that money directed toward that.
Mr. Turner.
Chair, Senator Foley, it certainly could be. It certainly could be, but if you're asking whether or not they need the match,
If they've
already bought the cameras, they don't need the match. The upgrade is a fully state funded program.
Senator Foley. Madam Chair and Mr. Turner, but this has gone by. You're saying that they can use the fact that they
purchased something 4 years ago or five, whenever they did, and they can use that as a match?
Mr. Chair.
Madam Chair, Senator Foley, if they purchased it 4 years ago or 5 years ago, that would be about the time of the racial profiling discussion that we had that was the basis of these original squad car camera grants. And that would mean that they would be technically upgrading, and according to the rider, they would not have to make a match.
Senator Rosa?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Would this be appropriate to ask about the supervised parenting grants on line 7, line 33? Are these new grants that are being established by the commissioner? New programs that are being...
Representative Paymar.
Senator Rosen, this is additional money. The supervised parenting centers are called now safe...
Safe visitation
centers. They're called different things around the state. The purpose is, especially when there's family violence situations, it's a place where the family court, civil court, or the civil court will order the parents to drop off the kids as a safe location so that the other parent can come and pick the child up without having any contact with the ostensibly the abusive parent. There's existing money for this in OJP. This is additional money for supervised parenting programs.
Senator Rosen.
Representative Paymar, there is nothing of this that could be included in the Health and Human Services budget.
No. Madam Chair.
Representative Paymar.
No, this is a public safety initiative. It's mostly deals with family violence situations where the parents, there's been an allegation of abuse. You would have in some situations where it's either a child abuse situation or an order for protection had been taken out. And one of the most difficult times is you don't have these centers is that when there's the pickup and the drop-off of kids, when there's a separation, it's very volatile for the parents and very traumatic for the children. And this way these programs, I don't know if you have one in your jurisdiction, but it's a...
Representative Paymar, my next question was, are there any out in Greater Minnesota, such as Rochester, Mankato, St. Cloud?
I think Senator Olson, do you know? I think you carried this bill, didn't you?
No, this wasn't my bill, Madam Chair, but I know there is one in Brainerd just south of my district.
I think that was actually the original one.
Mm-hmm.
Representative Hillstrom?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't happen to have the list with me, but I did see a chart, and yes, there are a number out in Greater Minnesota.
Okay, Mr. Turner.
Madam Chair, members, then we'll move on to page 9, the auto theft emergency grant. This is reimbursement for costs associated with the impoundment of stolen vehicles. I'd like to point out something here. This is probably the most significant typo that we have. It's a bit confusing. On 9.7 to 9.9, it reads, this amount shall be added to the department's base budget, period. Amount is a one-time appropriation.
That's a big OP.
Yeah. The intent was that it was a one-time appropriation. At one time, it was ongoing. When we had tails problems, it became a one-time appropriation, and so we would like permission to tell the advisor to strike on lines 9.7 to 9.8, this amount shall be added to the department's base budget.
Is everyone all right with giving staff the direction to go ahead and get that done? Okay. Yes, please. Mr. Turner.
Moving on, Madam Chair, then we have the crime victims grants. We have the four main crime victim program grants included here. It's $1.7 million each year for battered women shelters, domestic violence grants, general crime victim grants, and sexual assault victim grants. One thing I'd like to point out here that I think Mr. Carter already pointed out is because of tails problems, although we appropriate $1.7 million each year, for the base next biennium, we've only included $737,000 each year. The next rider is for what's called the COPS grants. We took the House position where the grants can be used for either new peace officers or police overtime. And then there's the last part of the rider directs part of the appropriation to Brooklyn Center and Brooklyn Park, a specific amount, $238,000 the first year and $270,000 the second.
Representative Hillstrom, do they have joint police departments? They're separate. Okay, thank you. Mr. Turner.
Page 10, we have the Youth Intervention Program. $750,000 each year. It's a one-time appropriation. And the legal advocacy for trafficking victims, like I said, this is a long list of Office of Justice programs. Then we have the homeless outreach, the defibrillators, both of which are one-time appropriations, the integrated domestic violence response framework, just a grant to the City of St. Paul to implement integrated domestic violence response framework. The project must develop a statewide model that may be used by local criminal justice agencies. It has a February 1st report date to the legislature. The next rider is children at risk, or what we call ACE, $250,000 the first year, providing services for children under the age of 10. We have a standard rider for the Department of Public Safety Office of Justice Programs that up to 2.5% of the grant funds may be used to administer the programs. Then moving on to page 12, starting at line 10 through page 15, line 10. This language increases the 911 monthly phone fee by $10 each year and dedicates the money to funding the operating costs of the 911 public safety communications radio system, or what we call ARMA. Then, if we move on to 15.10, the bill provides $186,000 in bonding authority to complete the system, the radio system's backbone statewide, backbone meaning radio towers. And should be completed by the year 2012. That's the estimated complete date. Moving on to page 16, we have the post board. We have the standard post board general fund transfer language down to 1630. Then we have actually what's standard peace officer training reimbursements riders. The difference is we increase the training reimbursements by $50,000 each year, so those numbers are up $50,000 from 2 years ago. So it's essentially new reimbursement authorization. Then on page 17, we have a rider that requires the board to revise and update pre-service courses and develop in-service courses relating to no-contact orders in domestic violence cases, and to reimburse peace officers who have taken these training courses. The writer goes on to have, it has minimum training requirements. It's fairly prescriptive. I believe the House appropriated $50,000 for this. The Senate did not. The post board has told us that they can do this without an appropriation. We have a Board of Private Detectives and Protection Agencies, Agent Services, just a standard appropriation rider. And we move on to the human rights. We have the Management Information System rider that was part of the government or the governor's recommendation. Then we have three riders. We have a survey which evaluates department outcomes, a working group on inmate complaints, inmates within the state correctional jail and state correctional systems, and then we have a piece on conciliation services. Then moving on to the Department of Corrections,
You have your standard...
Chris, 20.3.
We have...
I think there's a three.
Madam Chair, members, then we have the summary by fund, total appropriations for the department, and then for the institutions. Down at the end of page 20, we have standard Rush City contract language allowing the department to contract out or contract with other states or the federal government to rent beds at Rush City. This is a rider that we have every 2 years. Then the other rider under institutions is the offender reentry services, $400,000 each year for the Department of Corrections MCORP program. When we move on to the community services riders, once again, this is just follows the spreadsheet. We have, you know, intensive supervised release agents for challenge incarceration, intensive supervised release agents for conditional release. The bill funds the interstate compact for the first time that the legislature authorized the department to join and has yet to fund, and so this would provide first-time funding. Then sex offender civil commitment and tracking, $350,000 each year. We move into the three probation delivery systems, the CCA system, receiving $2.8 million each year. The CPO, the CCA is Community Corrections Act. Then the CPO, the County Probation Officer System, is at $600,000 each year. And then the DOC system, their probation supervision appropriation at $600,000 each year. Then we have another probation rider on caseload reduction. It's $2 million each year for adult and juvenile felon offender management, and it's distributed by the Community Corrections Act formula. In the Senate, we were prescriptive and said it had to be used for sex offender management. In the House, it just said for violent felon offender management, and we took the House language. Next rider is $500,000 each year for funding community-based sex offender treatment and sentencing to service. Then we have the standard rider for short-term offenders. The one major difference being is that we really increased the amount that goes to the counties. This will increase, presently we're reimbursing the counties $9 a day, and this should bring it up to $33 a day for housing short-term offenders. Then on page 23, we have offender reentry services, $550,000 each year. That's a DOC program. Then we have offender reentry grant for what is called the network, the people who contract for services for supervising inmates and people who do not accept their money if they are not successful. Then we have a rider for employment services for ex-offenders that's based or directed at North Minneapolis. We have a domestic abuse reentry grant. And then we have a reentry rider for productive day, and I believe that is directed at Duluth. On page 24, we have the rider for the mentoring grants, that will be discussed later. And the description of this program will be discussed later in the article. Then finally, we have under community services, we have a short-term offender study and report, requiring the commissioner to study the use and effectiveness of the short-term offender program and identify gaps in the current system relating to programming and reentry services for short-term offenders requires a November 1, 2007 legislative report date. Operation support is a straight appropriations rider. When we move on to sentencing guidelines, we have a require the sentencing guidelines to study the effectiveness of reentry programs and drug courts. There's no money attached to this rider. The guidelines commission said that they could conduct this study with current resources. However, we require another study of them on the next page, collateral sanctions committee, which, with their current resources, they don't believe they could properly complete. So this bill appropriates $100,000 for the collateral sanctions committee report. Finally, we have changes to the grid for controlled substance offenses. It requires the commission to propose change rankings for controlled substance offenses on the sentencing guidelines grid. And it requires it, it's prescriptive on what it must encompass. This is a Senate position that has been subject to extensive reworking within the by the conference committee. And then finally, that would just follow the spreadsheet. Then all we have left is program riders that flesh out one program housed in the Department of DOC, which is the mentoring grant for children of incarcerated parents. It explains the grant program, gives the criteria, requires a program evaluation. Then finally, we have five program riders for grant programs that are housed in the Department of Public Safety. Those are the homeless grant, outreach grants, and basically this is all program language explaining who the grant recipients are, you know, what the criteria is. Most of them require an annual report, but those five program writers are the homeless outreach grants, child advocacy center grants, demonstration project for high-risk adult grants, or what's called the network, and the reentry grant addressing domestic violence and inmate partner violence. Oh, and one more, the employment services for ex-criminal offenders, the pilot project in North Minneapolis. And Madam Chair and members, that is Article 1.
Questions on Article 1? If not, Mr. Backus, I think will take us through 2 and 3. Mr. Backus.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'll begin on page 32 of the Delete Everything Amendment. These are the Article 2 general crime provisions. The first section on pages 32-33 deals with domestic abuse, no contact orders. This is basically a compromise provision. We added a kind of a somewhat technical cross-reference that the House had about the types of programming these offenders would receive, and then a substantive provision that the Senate had, providing that it would be a felony if you commit a no contact order violation while possessing a dangerous weapon. Section 2 on page 34 deals with the qualified domestic violence-related offense definition. We took the Senate position here. There are technical differences only between the House and Senate. Sections 3 to 5 on pages 34-39 deal with the third-degree and fourth-degree crim sex changes. We took the House positions here. They were identical with the Senate. Section 6 on page 39 deals with the clarification on the effect of the pattern and predatory sex offender sentencing provision repeal. This was a House-only provision, and the Senate accepted that. Section 7, pages 39-40, deal with Internet solicitation of children. The conference committee took the Senate position. Basically, there were only technical and restructuring differences with the House, with the exception of an affirmative defense difference, in which we took the Senate position. Section 8 on pages 40-42 deal with the theft threshold issue. This was a Senate-only provision, and the conference committee accepted the Senate position. Sections 9 and 10, pages 42-43, are two new provisions dealing with theft enhancements and changes to the receiving stolen property law. These relate to the scrap metal issue. They were in Senate File 443, which was brought into the conference committee because the House had scrap metal provisions in it, and we took these Senate positions. Sections 11-15, pages 43-44, deal with burglary. We took the House provisions. They were House-only language. Section 16 on page 45 is a house loan provision that we accepted, a five-year felony for damage or theft to energy transmission and telecom equipment. Section 17 and 18, pages 45 to 46, these were changes to the criminal damage to property thresholds, and we took the house positions. There were technical differences only. Section 19 on page 46 was the ticket scalping repeal. We took the house position. It was identical to the Senate. Article 3 on page 47 is the DWI and driving-related provisions. Sections 1 and 4 to 5 on pages 47 to 49, these deal with the ignition interlock pilot project and the related DWI sentencing change. We took the House language with a clarifying amendment relating to the pilot project that limits the misdemeanor penalty applicable to it and applies the new pilot project guidelines to the existing ignition interlock law and statute. Section 2 on pages 47 to 48 deal with phlebotomists. We took the House position, which was identical to the Senate. Section 3 deals with driving records provided to law enforcement at no charge. We took the House position. It was a House-only provision. Section 6 gives effect to Canadian convictions for driving license purposes. We took the House position. It was a House-only provision. Sections 7 to 11 and 14 and 15, pages 50 to 54, these are the criminal vehicle operation changes. Both the House and Senate had these. They were mostly identical, except Senator Neville had language on defectively maintained motor vehicles. We took a compromised version of that, which scaled it back quite a bit. And we also clarified the language regarding homicide in that section. And then sections 12 and 13 on pages 52 to 53 deal with admissibility of lab reports, and we took the House position, which was identical to the Senate.
Questions on Articles 2 and 3?
Madam Chair?
Senator Neville.
I'm, maybe my memory just isn't that good, but section 12, 13, 14, 15 dealing with burglary. Did we adopt that in the working group? The policy working group?
Madam Chair and Senator Neville, no, I believe those were considered to have financial implications because there was a bad impact.
Okay.
They passed, a slightly narrower version passed the Senate Judiciary Committee and did not get a hearing, I don't think, in
okay.
Or did not move beyond the Finance Division of Senator Higgins.
All right.
Questions? And Ms. Purius is going to do sections, or Articles 4 and 5. Ms. Purius.
Madam Chair and members, Section 1 on page 54 is Senate language. It provides that a no-contact order be accompanied by a photo of the defendant if the photo is available. Section 2 is Department of Human Rights language. It allows them to deposit gifts and other funds in a special revenue account. And there was...
Senator Foley.
Lines 54.11 through 54.17 relate to something that did not have a position in the Senate and the other thing in the House, as we can see, is there was a study, and I would hope that you would delete that.
Senator Foley, when we were putting the bill together, Representative Paymar and I had quite a bit of discussion on this, and we thought this was a very important component. I know that Senator Bonoff has worked really hard on this. I think that it makes only good common sense that a no-contact order, if there is a verifiable photo that can be included with that, there should be a photo with that. And I think very strongly that it should be continued to be in this bill.
Madam Chair, I understand the value if the design and implementation of this has worked out so that it will solve the problem. I think that there's serious problems with getting the photo fit into the program. And so where an individual would have it, I don't know. Well, there's anyone here from the BCA, but they may have some inkling on that, too.
way I understand it, Senator Foley, it would be a matter of copying a picture from a database and pasting it into a Microsoft Word file. And I think probably most people in this room have done that and know that it's not really difficult. And so we're giving them until August 1st to, implement this, and I think that that's plenty of time to figure out their system to do.
Chair, I guess you can make that point that this is a good thing. The question is, there may be a lot of good things, but they went through the committee process and got through the Senate and the House, and I don't think this did, and I think that is not the way to do it.
Curious. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, Section 2 is the Department of Human Rights language, and there was nearly identical language in the House and Senate, and we took the Senate language. On page 56, Section 3, this section allows victims of domestic abuse to terminate their lease if they fear imminent abuse by remaining in the premises. We took the Senate language. There was similar House language. Section 4, was identical House and Senate language. It provides that sexual assault counselors may not be allowed to disclose information about a victim. This goes all the way to page 60. Sections 5 and 6 expands current law on employer retaliation. It provides that a victim of violent crime, provides that an employer must allow a victim of violent crime time off from work to attend criminal proceedings, and there was similar House language. We took the Senate position. Section 7 on page 62 is House language. It prohibits law enforcement from requiring a victim of criminal sexual conduct to submit to a polygraph exam. And then sections 8 through 12 on pages 63 through 64. This is House language. It was part of the auto theft grant program. It allows a victim reimbursement of towing and storage fees incurred due to impoundment of a recovered vehicle. Recovered stolen vehicle, excuse me. Article 5 is the Courts and Public Defenders Bill. Section 1 on page 65 reflects the new judgeships that we added. Sections 2, 3, and 4 are all part of the Judicial Branch Bill, and this updated and modified certain court provisions. There was identical House and Senate language. Section 5 on page 67 is House language. This provides court jurisdiction over truants until the truant's 19th birthday. Right now it stops at the child's 18th birthday. Section 6 is House language. It preserves a cause of action against a dissolved corporation for purposes of accessing available liability insurance. Section 7 is also a judicial branch provision with identical House and Senate language. Section 8 on page 69 is House language. This authorizes drug courts to charge defendants fees for participating. Section 9 is new language. It exempts from the good faith insurance provisions that you'll find in later on in this section. It exempts self-insurance pools. Section 10 and 11 are judicial branch provisions again. Section 12 was identical House and Senate language relating to Hennepin County forfeited bail proceeds. Sections 13 through 16 on pages 71 through 73 are all judicial branch provisions. Section 17 is Senate language. It provides a person proceeding in forma pauperis with a free copy of the court file. This is nearly identical to the House language, which said copies instead of copy. Section 18 is the good faith insurance practices language. It's new language. It requires insurers to act in good faith. It now has an exemption for arson investigations. It has a knowledge requirement and also allows insurers 60 days to cure an alleged violation. Sections 19 through 21 are judicial branch provisions, and that takes us to page 79. Page 79 is section 22. This is the public defender study. There was nearly identical House and Senate language except for the report due date, and we took the House position on that. Section 23 is a House provision. It's the good faith report. It directs the Commissioner of Commerce to monitor compliance with the good faith obligations. And then Section 24 is a repealer. This was House and Senate language. It repeals two judicial reports. One, an annual report on juvenile delinquency, another on court reporters. And then the last repealer section is a public defender provision. It repeals the $40 per hour reimbursement rate.
Any questions on these two articles? Mr. Dable, sections 6 through 8.
Yes.
Madam Chair and members, Section 6 deals with corrections. The first three sections relate to a Department of Corrections agency bill concerning NCOR revisions, and so that takes you 1 through 3, and that takes up the largest portion of this article, as 5 through 10 are also from that bill, as well as 16 and 20. Section 4 on page 82 requires the Department of Corrections to add the section to their biennial report to address reentry policies and funding. Section 5 requires the Department of Corrections to coordinate a per diem calculation formula and data collection from regional and county jails. As mentioned, 5 through 10 relate to the MnCOR provisions, which takes us to Section 11 on page 87.
That's why I'm silent.
On 87, Sections 11 and 12, again, are from a DOC policy bill that relate to defining the licensed mental health care professional, and that's this is from the Senate version. Sections 13 permits the Department of Corrections to gain access to unemployment data so that they may track post-confinement employment for offenders. Sections 14 and 15 are two initiatives from Ramsey County relating to how they administer their jail, and those are House positions. Section 16, as mentioned, is from the MnCOR bill. Section 17, as well, on page 90, and Section 19 on page 91 are two provisions from House File 196 regarding the mental health, and they deal with inmates with mental health and how they're treated upon intake as well as their release from confinement. And then Section 18 on 90 pertains to regional jails and the authority to withdraw from a regional jail agreement. Section 20 is a repealer, and as mentioned, that also relates to MnCOR.
Right through the window.
On page 91, Public Safety, Article 7, Section 1 of the bill is from the scrap metal bill, and that's Senate File 443 of the Third Engrossment. Section 2, which begins on 91 and goes on to 92, is a predatory offender regulation provision which cross-references strangulation so that those convicted of strangulation as a prior offense are eligible for predatory offender registration. Section 3 on page 92 is a Senate provision which is a technical provision to clean up the fire safety account language to bring it in compliance with how the fund is currently operating. Sections 4 through 6 are Senate provisions from Senate File 1540, and they deal with the gang oversight, criminal oversight, and a report from on the criminal. Section 7 on page 95 is another provision from the scrap metal bill, and that deals with educational materials.
Section 8 is another provision dealing with CRIMNET Task Force. Section 9 is also related to CRIMNET and is, I believe, a CRIMNET initiative. Sections 10 through 19 are from Senate File 1194, which is the cigarette safety bill, and that is as slightly amended through agreement of the conferees and stakeholders. That takes us to section.
Madam Chair, let me ask a question on those sections. Was that on the House side coming into this conference committee? Which bill was that provision in? House side?
Madam Chair and members, conference committee members, that it was a House initiative, and the agreement took the Senate language.
No, it isn't my notes.
Do we have a Senate position on this?
Which bill? Which issue?
Don't worry about it.
I guess this is the fire safe cigarettes or something. Does the Senate have a position on that yet?
Mr. Chair and Senator Neville, the Senate had a bill, Senator Morty's bill. I believe it's now on general orders. It made it through the policy committees, but it hasn't. I don't believe it's passed the Senate. But the provisions were nearly identical to the House provisions. There were just a few tweaks.
Well, let me ask, Madam or Mr. Chair, is there fiscal consequences to this? Because this was not discussed in the policy working group either, I don't think.
Senator Neville, there is a fee that is charged. That's why it came to the Judiciary or the Public Safety Finance Committee. There's a fee that's deposited in the fire safety account. Is it the fire safety account for certifying the testing cigarette manufacturing? All these provisions were signed off by all the parties. That was the fiscal impact. There's no.
All right.
I think there are some civil penalties also.
So, Mr. Chair, what you're saying is that all the parties who are interested in that provision are in agreement?
That's correct, Senator.
Okay. All right.
Please go on.
Mr. Chair, members, continuing on page 107, section 21 is the major piece of the scrap metal bill. That is the Senate position with the addition of the House position on video cameras. That takes us to all the way through to page 111, which is the final clause from the cigarette safety bill, which would, if the federal government passes standards on cigarette safety, that would preempt the state law. The final section in Article 8 is a Collateral Sanctions Committee, which is a Senate position. Article 9 begins on page 112. Article 8. This is entitled Emergency Communications, and all of the language in here came from the department, and it is largely the Senate language, but the concepts and language is very close to what the House had. But all seven sections are related to the administration of the 911 fee and collection of the 911 fee in conjunction with the funding of the armor system.
Thank you, Mr. Deeble. If I could draw your attention, members, to Article 1, page 30, there was a drafting error. This is relates to the demonstration project, the reentry demonstration project. And if it is, the Senate language was supposed to be in this bill, and I explain it. If the network is indeed chosen by the Department of Corrections to provide this demonstration project, we had a provision in there which should stay in there that any state funding must go for inmates who had been incarcerated. But there was also some eligibility language that was in the Senate that would allow this program to still work with high-risk adults, but that state funding could not be utilized. So what I'd... So what I'd like to ask the committee, if we can just... do you see where that is, Mr. Diebold?
On the takes.
We're suggesting that it would go into Section 19, right before Subdivision 4, the eligibility criteria that was in the Senate language. So I would like to know if the committee would be okay to give staff the authority to correct that error. You guys see where it is? Are there any objections to that? Okay, then we've got that. Okay, members, I'm not sure where... Sorry, who can explain this? But we'll proceed.
Could we go back to a question back on Article 7?
Sure.
Section 21 of page 110. It has to do with the scrap metal. Mr. Chair, and maybe Mr. Backus can help us. The video security cameras, was that in the House position or the Senate position?
Which is the scrap yards? Senator Rosen, that was in the House position.
And Madam Chair, we took that position out because it was tough for some scrap metal dealers, especially out in greater Minnesota, to be able to accommodate that section.
And I believe that the House, that provision stayed in all the way along. So it was a House provision that we took.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, other questions? Thank you to our fine counsel for walking us through those provisions. Comments from our committee members?
Committee members.
I think Representative Smith wanted to hear from the corrections folks.
Madam Chair, yes, I would like to know what the number of state employees will be terminated as a result of what's in front of us.
Somebody from corrections, please. Good evening.
Dennis Benson, I'm the Deputy Commissioner for the Institutions Division for the Department of Corrections. With about an $8.34 million in compensation inflation problem in our budget for the biennium, that equates to, we believe, 168 positions. 140 of those would be in the Institutions Division, and 81 in the Field Service Division, corrections agents, supervising agents. In addition to that, depending on how many we would have to lay off compared to positions we would eliminate through attrition, we may have to lay additional staff off to pay for the severance. There's a severance cost of about 33%. That's one-time money. But in the past, when we've had to lay staff off, we have to cover that severance as well. So in many cases, that would be junior staff. It might not be a lot, but that is a consideration. The other consideration is this is assuming that the contracts come in at 4.25%, which we know is a low number. It comes in higher than that. If it comes in at 5 or 5.5, then it would result in additional positions being eliminated and or layoffs. So that's the facts as we know them today based on what assumptions are in front of us.
Representative Smith.
Madam Chair, thank you. Deputy Commissioner Benson, does the severance pay quotient, 30% to 33% severance pay issue you mentioned, does that add to the 168 positions lost? And if so, how many does that add to that?
Commissioner Benson.
Madam Chair and Representative Smith, again, it would depend on how many we lay off compared to how many we would be able to just eliminate through attrition. If there are openings and we don't have to fill those positions, then there would be no severance payout. In the field services area where there's not a lot of turnover, we would probably be looking at more layoffs than just elimination of positions or not filling open positions. In the institutions division, where we do have some turnover, there would probably be fewer. I know I'm not giving you hard numbers, but those are the kinds of things that would determine that. But there would be a few. It probably wouldn't be a lot.
That's all, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Benson, how many positions are currently open?
Madam Chair and Representative Hillstrom, I don't know that number today, but I can tell you that in a department of 4,000 people, that ebbs and flows from 50 to 200, I suppose, at any given time that are in the process of being filled or have given a two-week notice or something like that. So there is some turnover, certainly in our agency our size.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Benson, given these positions that you're speaking of laying off, how many of those do you anticipate would come out of the top or management or the commissioner's office?
Commissioner Benson.
Madam Chair and Representative Hillstrom, again, I think until about 5 or 6 hours ago, we were still hopeful that there might be some kind of resolution to our problem here. We haven't begun to determine where those positions would come from. In the past, when we've had to cut staff in our agency, we try to do that consistent with percentages. If the percent cut is, for instance, in 2002 was 5%, we took 5% from management, 5% from line staff, 5% from MAPE, 5% from MMA. So we would look at what's available in the institution, and I, quite frankly, we'd look at where we could do the least amount of harm.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you believe that there will be leftover finances from any of these other line items? And if there was dollars left over, would you anticipate that you would be using it for staff?
Madam Chair and Representative Hillstrom, in a budget of approaching $500 million, we are unable to get the checkbook to go to zero at the last day of the biennium. Unfortunately, we don't know that until about the last day of the biennium. So it's difficult to use appropriated dollars in different areas until we get down the road a ways to understand where our budget pressures are going to be as we approach the end of the biennium. If we have warm winters, maybe we won't use as much fuel and utility. I can tell you that last year we were about 33% under fuel and utility, and the line item this year isn't going to plug that hole. So we, again, in a budget that has pretty much doubled in a little over a decade, or certainly the population has, there's not a lot of extra money sloshing around in our budget.
Chair, just one final statement.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that this conference committee should actually consider, in the event that there is going to be cuts, that they direct the Department of Corrections to take it equally proportional between the Department of Corrections administration as well as line staff, because I would hate to see line staff only be laid off and the top to not feel any of the pain.
Commissioner, you had said that that is your practice. Will you continue that if funding continues?
Madam Chair, we certainly will, and I can tell you that our priorities are going to be supervision in the community and trying to keep the cell blocks of our facilities safe for our staff and our offenders.
We have that on the record now. Senator Rosen, then Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Deputy Commissioner Benson, out of the 140 positions in the institutions, those are the main people doing the supervising. Roughly, what is their base salary, or how much would one of those positions be worth?
Madam Chair and Senator Rosen, with fringe, I think we figure them at about $50,000 a year is an average.
Another question, Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Deputy Commissioner Benson, you mentioned today that, it sounded like you were saying that the contracts are not yet negotiated. I thought I understood from your prior testimony that contracts had been negotiated at 4.25%. Today you're saying you can't be sure because you don't know what they're going to come in at. Could you please clarify that for us? What's been negotiated and what hasn't?
Commissioner?
Madam Chair and Representative Liebling, again, contracts have not been negotiated. They have begun the negotiation process. That starts right after the first of the year of the budget year, every 2 years. They have been, Department of Finance plugs in numbers for us in terms of what they believe those contracts will come in at. The governor put, I believe, 2% each year across the board on the table in the budget, so that certainly in most cases becomes the bottom. That becomes the beginning point of where contracts are negotiated in terms of across the board increases. So we sort of know that that number is going to be 2% or probably greater, depending on what the unions can negotiate. In addition to that, Department of Employee Relations estimates what the additional insurance increases will be. Department of Finance also tells us what that number is, so we have a clue what that is. We absolutely know what staff every year are going to get a step increase, so we're able to pretty accurately predict what that's going to be. There's some turnover during the year, but that we're able to understand that number pretty closely. So the variables are how close is doer on insurance inflation. As we get a little bit further down the road, that number becomes a little clearer, and also the across-the-board increases. So again, as I said, if the numbers are as they were given to us by finance, these are the numbers that you should plug in for each of these areas of inflation in the compensation adjustment, it would be over 4.25. Those numbers, the governor plugged in 4.25. The actual numbers, according to a two across the board, the step increases and health care that finance gave us is somewhere between 4.25 and 4.8, 4.9. In our MAPE contract, it's up around 5%. So I don't think there's much question that the contracts are going to all come in 4.25 plus.
Thank you, Commissioner. Any other questions for the Commissioner? Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Senator Neville.
Madam Chair, let me just make sure that the money that we're appropriating for the institutions and the money we're appropriating for community services, they can't move one to the other, can they?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair and Senator Neville, they are appropriated to a specific program. We can't do that without our EBO's approval.
Well, under what circumstances could the EBO give approval? For example, if you ran short of money in the institutional budget, but you had extra money in the community services budget, Under what circumstances could you move it over?
Madam Chair and Senator Neville, under those circumstances, we can write a letter requesting a transfer of funds from one program to another, and we have done that. For instance, we've moved money from the institution's budget to work release, which is actually, that budget is actually held in the community services area. So we have some flexibility, but we also have, we have to jump through some hoops to do that, so we can't recklessly move that money from one program to another. Pass-through money, grant money, we can't touch any of that. That's all directed by legislation.
Well, Madam Chair, let me get more specific. You say you're about $8 million short on compensation in the institutional. No. Is that right?
Agency.
In the institutional agency. And it looks like what we're funding in this budget is, where is it? Under community services. Actually, we're under the governor, it looks like on that too. Oh no, I'm looking at the wrong sheet.
Yeah.
Are we under the governor's rec on that too?
Senator Neville, we are.
Okay. So there may not be much in that part of the budget to shift over to institutions either, but Give me a scenario under which you think you could move it over if you absolutely needed to prevent 150 layoffs of security guards.
Commissioner.
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Neville, in my 11 years, I can't remember going to community services looking for money to fund something in the institutions division. It's usually the other way around. And I say that because the workforce in community corrections is much more stable. There's a lot less turnover among agents than there are among correctional officers. So that really isn't, I think, a viable option going forward. In our central office, that's a very, very small pot of money. There's only a couple hundred thousand that potentially could become available. The other point I want to make in terms of kind of spreading the pain around is, remember now, in 2002, we went through a per diem reduction exercise where we cut 200 positions. Many of those were middle managers and managers as well as line staff. And then in 2003, again, when we had the budget crisis, we're cut by about $55 million. So in terms of that middle management and management level, we're managing this agency leaner today than we were when we had 5,000 inmates in it.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Any other comments or questions from the committee members? Senator, or Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
It's habit, I'm sorry.
I just want to ask whether staff recalls, was there a deficiency for the Department of Corrections this year, and if so, what was that?
Representative Liebling, we actually have, I know, one item on line 203, almost $4 million, and it's called annualized 2006 session costs, and maybe one of our staff can tell us exactly what that might have been. But I think it was an item that we put in that we didn't have money for the tails. So we're putting that forward. Mr. Carter, you can probably explain it way better than I.
Madam Chair, committee members, I believe that was in the 206 session where they funded corrections and they shorted them in the tails request. So this simply makes up that funding that they were shorted.
Have we done a deficiency appropriation for corrections in previous years? Either of you remember?
I believe we did the last one in 2006. We have had, I think, a few deficiency requests. Mr. Bitt, two or three, is it deficiency requests?
Okay, thank you. Representative Liebling?
Madam Chair, yes, I'd like to know further you know, what those deficiencies consist of. In other words, how much flexibility would the department have to come back next year and say, guess what, we actually spent a little more than we had and get it made up that way as a deficiency? Is there anything that there are rules that restrict them, or maybe you could just give me some historical idea of what kinds of items have resulted in deficiency in the past.
Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, we have had deficiencies quite a few times. For example, we almost every year in the past we've had a disaster deficiency where we need the federal match. Another example is the Board of Judicial Standards for the last 3 or 4 or even 5 years, I think, they've had cases where they cannot meet the needs, so they have to come to the back to the legislature for a deficiency, and they can go through the governor. The governor makes a recommendation, and the state usually...
Right. Madam Chair, Representative Lee. Thank you. I'm thinking specifically, though, of the Department of Corrections.
Mr. Carter.
Madam Chair, Representative Lee. Right. I think, like Mr. Benson said, I think there's been 3 past examples where we have had deficiencies from the Department of Corrections. I remember specifically, I believe, health care was one where they fell short on their health care costs.
So, Madam Chair, so in other words, if the employee costs, that would be an appropriate subject for a deficiency if employee costs ended up being like health care or need for additional staff or something like that would result from perhaps unanticipated increases in inmate population or something.
Mr. Carter?
Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, yes, but it would probably, you know, they would have to wait till next year, and then they would have to ask for a deficiency and go through the governor's office and get to the legislature.
Thank you.
Other questions? Senator Neville.
Madam Chair, on Article 5, Section 18, I see we've included the good faith insurance practices. And throughout this conference committee, there's been, I guess, an understanding that the parties were trying to negotiate agreed language or compromise language.
Can I interest you in have a page number?
Page 74.
Thank you. Go ahead.
I'm just wondering if the parties who are interested in this would like to comment whether this is agreed upon language.
Who's here to talk about the good faith provision? Mr. Cross, 74 is the page number.
Yeah, I did.
Mr. Carlson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Members, my name is Joel Carlson. I own a legal research and government affairs business here in St. Paul, and I represent the Minnesota Trial Lawyers Association. Senator Neville and members, the good faith provision that is on page 74, section 18, is the result of a lot of work and compromise, I know, at least on our behalf. The bill that was before you was a first and third party bad faith provision. It also provided direct action against insurance companies when they owe and have the obligation to the injured party. The bill before you comes to you as first party good faith, no direct action. It has a proof standard that is fairly consistent with good faith practices across the country. This is this provision is law in 46 states in some form or another, and I cannot tell you that it is or will ever be peace in the valley, but if we're going to have this protection for consumers, this is what is totally consistent with other states, what others have told us would be required to have them support the bill, and taking out the direct action, I think, was a significant change. But I can't tell you, Senator Neville, that this is a peace in the valley. We have worked mightily to achieve that, and I understand that the industry would maybe never want to have this obligation, but we think it's important for consumers, and we appreciate the conference committee including this in the bill.
So, Mr. Carlson, there is no longer a direct action against insurance companies in the bill?
Madam Chairman and members, there is not. Not in auto policies and in any other way.
Other questions on this provision, well, Senator Neville?
Madam Chair, would the insurers like to go on the record and comment on this provision or not?
Mr. Chairman and members, I've talked to Mr. Franzen with State Farm, and I know the other insurers have had the language since Thursday of last week, but so if they want to comment on it, that's, I don't know what they're likely to say. I never like to ask a question I don't know the answer to.
Gentlemen?
It's important to get it on
record. Would anybody like to comment? Anybody like to comment?
Madam Chair, members, my name is Doug Franzen. I represent the Property Casualty Insurers of America. I did have a conversation tonight with Mr. Carlson that basically would look at the language and see if it were possible to reach a compromise. I hadn't seen the language till it was just put out. Under the language put forth, there's a lot of problems I see. I don't know if it's intentional or not. One, for example, is health insurance appears to be back in the bill throughout the deliberation and all the committees throughout both houses. Health had been excluded. I also represent Blue Cross Blue Shield, so that did catch my attention. There are, again, language problems, and I have not had a chance really to look at this. And at this point, I could say on behalf of my client, this does not represent, although I know and we do appreciate the work that Mr. Carlson's put into this, this does not represent something that we would say is a middle ground or an acceptable compromise.
Thank you, Mr. Franzen. Who else is there?
Go ahead.
Mr. Johnson. Come over.
Madam Chair?
Senator Neville?
Just clarify. On page 74, line 21, it seems like it excludes policy delivered by a health carrier. Does it include health insurance?
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman and members, this language has been in the bill since early February, and I would tell you that it is our belief and intention that 74.18 through 74.23, that language applies to an insurance policy other than a workers' compensation policy, a Medicare supplement, or contract as specified in 62A01. 011 subdivision 3. We intended to exempt them, and they have been exempt. We have a different procedure for those appeals, and we have not included them, and we believe them to be exempt by that language.
Madam Chair, I agree.
Mr. Franzen.
I agree and respect Mr. Carlson's intent. The language is different, however. For example, I think the language both in House File 829, the engrossment and Senator Clark's bill, and I have a 327 date, basically exempted a policy or contract of a health carrier as defined in section 62A.011. When we look at page 74, I believe what you see is that exemption is modified by or a Medicare supplement policy or contract. It may be just a drafting error, but I believe the entire exemption is limited to Medicare supplement, and a number of other products that the health carriers. So I believe this is different language. It may have been there at some point, but I believe as the bill worked through the process, the language was a policy or contract of a health carrier as defined in section 62A.011. And that would be acceptable language to us.
Mr. Franzen, on 74.21, continuing on that same sentence, though, or delivered in this state by a health carrier as defined in 62A.
Right. Madam Chair, I do read that entire sentence as being modified by, or at least limited by, Medicare supplement policy, and I don't think that is the intention of the drafter, but I believe that is how it would operate.
Senator Neville, did you have your hand up?
Well, I did. I was going to ask either Senator House Counsel if they could clarify.
Also, what do we mean in here?
Yeah.
Ms. Furious?
Madam Chair, Senator Neville, I read it as he did, with it being modified by the Medicare.
So you agree with Mr. Franzen's interpretation?
Yes, ma'am. Just looking at it now.
The House Counsel, could you suggest a way to redraft it so it clearly excludes all health policies?
Mr. Diebel's is curious.
Well, let me.
They're working on it.
Okay. Before they're working, Mr. Franzen, would that make a difference?
If
we were able to clarify the definition of an insurance policy to exclude all health insurance policies, would that matter to your position?
Madam Chair,
Mr. Franzen.
Senator Neville, halfway. I'm up here wearing two hats, one on behalf of Blue Cross Blue Shield, and that certainly would take care of that issue. However, on behalf of the property casualty insurers, there are some other issues here that I still think need some work.
Can you suggest any changes?
Madam Chair, Senator, there's language or substance? Madam Chair, Senator, quite frankly, this is something that there's some ambiguities in the language, even if it is restricted to first party. It's very loose. If you look at line 74.7, 74.8, I believe the expressed intention is to limit that to first party, but I'm not sure that it does, that specifies the relationship between an insurer and an insured. It's that I, as the insurer, have to act in good faith in connection with any matter that an insured claim under an insurance policy. I'm not sure that precludes third parties. I know that's not the proponent's intention, but I think that is a drafting issue. And I hope I'm wrong on that.
Well, Madam Chair, can we make motions to amend at any time? I mean, with all due respect, it's hard to try to mediate this at this point, but we don't have another point.
I think I'm up for fixing errors,
yeah,
or in the case of what we thought it was isn't what it is, I'm not sure that I want to get into wholesale amendments at this point.
Well, Madam Chair, with respect to the last point made by Mr. Franzen on page 74, line 8, if we deleted the words any matter involving and just said in connection with an insured's claim, does that clarify it better to make it clear that it's a first-party action from your perspective?
Madam Chair, Senator, it's definitely better. I'm not sure it's the best. I'd also like to defer to Mr. Johnson from the Insurance Federation. There are a number of insurers that I do not represent that certainly have an opinion on these issues.
Senator Olson,
Madam Chair, I was just simply going to say that I understood this was a compromise where we've accepted some language that the insurance companies wanted. And in fact, for example, I was very much not in favor of Subdivision 5, which provides a right to cure for 60 days, considering that insurance companies already under the Unfair Claims Practices Act should be doing these things. And now we're giving them an extra 60 days and probably requiring them to obtain an attorney in order to comply with the provisions of this act, whereas if we didn't have that right to cure in there for the protection of insurance companies, they'd be much more likely to deal with the insured in good faith to begin with, so we're kind of giving them a free ride for 60 days. So now coming at this date and just kind of accepting any suggestions the insurance company wants to make to water this bill down even further in terms of consumer protections seems to me to be kind of circumventing the process of working on something and coming up with language that people thought they could live with, whether they liked it or not. Certainly neither party is getting everything they want with this language.
I think that's a definition of a compromise, isn't it? Senator Neville.
Well, Madam Chair, I'm not trying to water anything down. I'm trying to clarify. And I think it was represented that this was intended to cover bad faith in first-party claims, and at least the intent, I think, of Mr. Carlson was that you didn't interpret insurance policy to include health insurance. So I'm trying to clarify those two points, and I think we could write it a little bit better. So I'm not trying to water it down. I just want to make sure that both sides know what's happening. I'd like to move that on page 74, line 8, we delete the words any matter involving, so that it would now read in connection with an insurance claim. I think that makes it at least a little more certain that we're talking only about first-party bad faith claims. I think it clarifies.
Okay, we haven't heard from Mr. Carlson yet on that piece, but I saw you nodding at some point. So,
Madam Chair and members, I would only say that the language that we picked up there is what Senator Scheid offered in the Commerce Committee, and we used it identically as she to restrict first-party claims. So we just used her language.
Do you think that the clarification that Senator Neville is proposing...
to the extent that helps make it clear, we're fine with that.
All right. Okay, members. On Senator Neville's motion that on 74.8, the three words, any matter involving, are deleted. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Adopted.
Okay. And then,
looks like council's still working on the other piece.
Maybe I could give some direction to council, if you're willing. What I would like to suggest is that on page 74, line 18, insurance policy, put a colon after other than and create subs under there of A, B, C, it's, or something like, so it's clear that it's other than, and then list A, B, and C, so that we can clearly take out workers' comp, Medicare supplement, and health insurance, and mutual fire insurance, I guess, whatever the exceptions are, so that it's clear we're not modifying one to the other.
Okay.
Maybe I shouldn't be giving you instructions how to do that, but I think that would work. It'd help me understand it as a lawyer.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just curious as to if any of these modifications are changing anyone's perspective on whether or not they might support the provision, because when deals are negotiated and people are working very hard to get something that works, sometimes one person's sentence when you leave the room then changes the whole negotiated agreement. And so I just want to be certain that we're messing around with this and we're actually moving towards more consensus rather than just messing around with it and not necessarily having all the stakeholders at the table.
Representative Hillstrom, I would say that any time we can make the meaning of law more clear, it helps everybody. And I think Senator Neville's trying to do it in a very gentle way. And having worked with him on this committee this year, I know that he's very adamant that what is written is what we mean. And so I see him continuing to try to do that in this piece. And I admit that I think that paragraph is really confusing. So I think it would behoove us to get it so that people know what it means. I'm very cautious, however, about opening up to lots of other amendments, because I do know that we are going to have people working all night on this bill, and I don't want them to be cursing us while they're at it, because we're making lots of changes. So I think that if we can make this clear in this provision, it helps us all, and so let's take a little time to do it, but let's not go wacko on it either.
There's a good legislative term. Mr. Johnson, while they're working on language.
Yeah, I'm chairing the conference committee members, Bob Johnson, Insurance Federation of Minnesota. We're probably the umbrella trade group that has more insurers involved as anybody. We don't support what's before the committee. We're not a party to the negotiated settlement here, so I hate to back this up to the square one, but we're not. So this isn't a compromise that our association, A, is either a part of or is supporting. So I guess if there was a question about that, at least I can speak for a pretty big block of the insurance industry, and the answer is no. So I...
On the record.
That's on the record. That's our position. And there's a lot of details which you probably don't want to get into right here, or the amendments at the Senate Judiciary Committee, that Senator Betzold had taken some provisions out of Senate File 2173 that are back in this language in the bill. And this has been a moving, constantly moving target in some of the word changes. There's new language here that's never appeared anywhere in any bill, at any committee, at any discussion, period, ever before the printing of this bill. So I know this is probably not the time of day to open that up and ask the questions about what it's intended to do, because we've not had any discussions about what it's intended to do. The Township Mutuals do not support the language that's in the bill. They publicly stated that if there's an intention to exclude the 99 members of the Minnesota Association of Farm Mutual Insurance Companies, they do not support this. So if that's its purpose, then that's not an agreement, because I've talked to their executive, I've talked to their lobbyists, and I know that's a true statement. So I don't know, Madam Chair, where you want to go with some of that. I mean, there's new language. We can talk about it, what it's intended to accomplish, whether it's accomplishes what it's intending to do, but it's never been discussed at a committee. So that's just a factual statement, what I told you. And,
right.
And some of the language, the changes and the nuances, again, you know, the report to the Commerce Committee, Senator Betzold took that out of Senate File 2173 at the Senate Judiciary Committee hearing. I don't know, but I don't know what the appetite is or the desire here at this time of night and on the bill. And so I guess the key thing is that we're not a part of, and we don't support what's before the committee
okay.
this evening.
Representative Kamar.
Mr. Johnson, I don't want to get into the details of the provision either, but I'm just curious, is there a good faith provision that the insurance industry would support, given the fact that 46 other states have similar provisions in law?
Well, Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair, Representative Paymar, I think that the answers are a couple of comments, that we have good faith provisions and statutes in Minnesota, as do virtually all states in our Claim Settlement Practices Act. It's the act that we've discussed in earlier committees. And the 46 states is quite a varying combination of a few states have state laws like this. The majority have common law development at their Supreme Court, some sort of a remedy. We have a third-party remedy in Minnesota, as the trial lawyers have testified at committee. It's the first party that's been the discussion. So we have a third-party remedy. And on the first party, I don't know if there's language. We haven't arrived at it yet. We haven't. So I think from the industry's perspective, we have commented, as we have, about the current enforcement remedies in terms of the Claim Settlement Practices Act period. And the action
Senator
on the contract.
Wilson.
So.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Paymar. In response to what Mr. Johnson has testified, since that is on the record, I would just like to say that every time this issue has been before the courts, Mr. Johnson and his group representing the insurance industry has opposed the common law remedy that's available in most other states, saying that it's for this body to come up with and fashion a statutory remedy for a consumer, which is what we're doing with this legislation. Since, unlike all those other states, we haven't had a remedy in common law, that's been opposed by the insurance industry. And we haven't had a remedy in statute either, because the remedy that's in statute or the legislation that we have under the Unfair Claims Practices Act does not provide any remedy for the insured. And so much as I may wish that this remedy were a little bit more consumer-friendly than it is, it's certainly a step in the right direction in bringing Minnesota in line with the other 46 states that provide some type of remedy for an insured when the insurance company acts in bad faith.
Thank you.
Senator Nick.
Madam Chair, I missed the committee hearing when we had the hearing in the Senate, so I didn't hear all the testimony there, but let me just ask why... If the insurance companies are familiar with the Unfair Claims Practice Act, but that doesn't provide a private remedy, why didn't the trial bar just seek to get a private remedy under the same Unfair Claims Practice Act, which they are familiar, what they're familiar with, what the duty is under those provisions, instead of trying to do it this way?
Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chair and members, that was probably my effort to pass this in 1998 or so, and that didn't work. What I can tell you is that I have found 20 states that have statutory remedies, and we've looked at all of them. And this is as close as I can come to address the concerns that have been raised in our state and still be close to what the remedies are in the 20 statutory states that I have found. And so we can do the 72A 201 fix with one sentence saying that you have the right remedy for your damages to do that, but we have tried that in the past and that has not been successful. I think I have the language in my file, but this seems to be a preferred alternative, so it spells out what the proof standard is, which is added here, and what the responsibilities are. And as to the new language, I would just tell the committee that the new language that I'm aware of that hasn't been discussed before tries to make it more clear for the policy rules on 74.23. At Mr. Franzen's request, we exempted out the joint underwriting authority. He's right. That has not been discussed anywhere else. I added that at his request. And the third thing that is added that is new is that we made clear that an insurer doesn't violate their good faith obligation by conducting arson investigation to its completion. We added those at the request of others, and that's the new language that is here. But beyond that, and the Medicare supplement issue we're dealing with, I added at the request of the health insurers. I was happy with it the way it was worded.
Council, are we getting close to some clarification in the paragraph?
Ms. Perius, help us out here, please.
Madam Chair, we looked at the Senate language in Senate File 2173, the second engrossment, and came up with comparable language in the amendment. So on line 74.18, after than, insert a colon, and then in parens, a lowercase Roman numeral 1. On page 74, line 19, after contract, insert a semicolon, and in parens, lowercase, Roman numeral 2. On that same line, delete, or a Medicare supplement, and insert A. Page 74, line 20, delete as specified in section 62A.011, subdivision 3, clause 10, page 74, line 21. Excuse me, there's no changes on that line. Page 74, line 22, delete the first comma and insert a semicolon. And then after or, insert in parens a lowercase Roman numeral 3. And I think that's the end.
Senator Neville, does that do it?
Well, the intent is then that we would be accepting out workers' comp policies, healthcare policies, and township mutual fire insurance companies or farmers mutual insurance companies. So we'd make it clear there are three exceptions. And my understanding is that's what the trial lawyers intended. So I'd like to move that language.
All right. Senator Neville's motion. Do we need to have it read again, or do we all kind of get the idea? We all get the idea. Okay, on Senator Neville's motion, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Adopted. Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Anything else, or are we about ready to wrap up? Senator Rosen.
Madam Chair, in the drug courts on line 43 of the spreadsheet, there is a significant drop from the House position of $6 million. The Senate position was almost $2 million, and we dropped down to $4.2 million. I guess I'd like to know from somebody in the audience what that's going to do to the system, the drug court system, the ones that are already in existence or the ones that are being planned for the future.
Is there anybody here? I know that Senate Counsel did some looking at how much was necessary to maintain and how much beyond that was new drug courts. Mr. Carter, do you remember that number? It was 3.5? Mr. Turner, do you? We're looking. Okay.
Madam Chair, too, on that point, we talked to the courts today, and they said they're also anticipating some federal money to start some new drug courts, and they may be able to clarify that if someone is here.
Someone here from tell us? Ms. Dozel. Tell us on the record how one pronounces your last name.
Dosal.
Dosal. Thank you.
It's Dosal. For the record, Sue Dosal, the State Court Administrator. Madam Chair and Senator Rosen, at this level, as Mr. Carter indicated, we're really talking about maintaining the drug courts that we have going right now where the federal grants are going away. It wouldn't allow too much, if anything, maybe $100,000 for new and expanded drug courts. As we indicated, we're hopeful that perhaps there could be some federal money that might be available that would allow us to continue, but it certainly, at this level, does significantly reduce our ability to add new drug courts.
Madam Chair, Ms. Dosal, when do you expect to know about this federal money? Is this for sure?
Sure. I don't know that when we'll know. This is through the Department of Public Safety and the Office of Traffic Safety, and I've just heard that there may be some money for DWI drug courts that would be available, that could be available. And I think it's probably this summer where we might know that. I don't know if Mary Ellison is here.
I'm not sure.
We just hope, but I don't know that we know for sure.
Madam Chair, for the record, and as you can probably all tell, I've been beating the Greater Minnesota drum here tonight. That is, drug courts are being implemented out in Greater Minnesota, and they're having success, and they're expecting great success with our drug courts. That's because there is a collaboration amongst the counties to make these work. Some of their bi, some are tri-county collaborations. So I'm very concerned about this drop.
Representative Paymer.
Madam Chair and Senator Rosen, let me say also on the record that I'm very concerned about it also. And there's no bigger proponent of drug courts on our committee than myself. And unfortunately, when we got this latest target, of course, we had to cut off over $12 million from the budget, and we're $6 million below the governor's recommendation.
And Senator Rosen, what Mr. Turner found in his notes was that this amount should give us about $300,000 for new drug courts. Not nearly as much as we wanted, but as Representative Paymar said, we were dealt kind of a very slim hand. Right, anything else? Looks like we're about ready to wrap up. Senator Neville, Senator Foley?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Someone from Corrections ready to speak.
Commissioner Benson? Who's still here? So you're behind the pole from my line of sight, so. Welcome back. Senator Foley.
Madam Chair and Commissioner Benson, I note looking through the spreadsheet that the House, the Senate, and the Conference Committee have all greater funding than the governor has. Is the governor coming out with supplemental things? What's happening there? And why would we be in danger of laying people off if the governor is not looking at more money than what we're looking at?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair and Senator Foley, in the in the Institutions Division and in the Community Services Division, the governor does fund compensation inflation at 4.25%. In the Operation Support Division, he funded it at 2%, which is the management or central office division. It's three different areas where we speak to compensation adjustment in the spreadsheet.
Senator Neville?
Madam Chair, this is going to be a challenging amendment, but what I'd like to do is orally move to increase the Department of Corrections budget by $4 million, $2 million a year, and reduce from the Department of Public Safety Office of Justice Programs, $4 million to be determined after and if we increase corrections. And, Madam Chair, I just don't think that we can afford to risk laying off 150 security guards. And it looks like from public safety, where my recollection is we were about $10 million over the governor's recommendation for Office of Justice Programs. I don't have anything against those programs that we're funding there, but as I look at it in terms of the core services that we need to do, Corrections doesn't have control over how many inmates they get. We're increasing public defenders, we're increasing judges, we're increasing probation agents, and we're decreasing correctional officers, an area that I consider to be quite a core function of this conference committee. I think they're short $8 million. I'd like to restore at least four of it, and I would propose that it come out of the out of the Department of Public Safety. I'd prefer just to get a vote on conceptually to increase it by four, and then I'll propose, I mean, with the help of the committee, I'd like to propose that we figure out where the $4 million should come from, but it would come from that area. That's the area that I think, the only area that we could possibly take $4 million from.
Members, I was really hoping that since the chairs on the behalf of the conference committee had come to agreement, that would be the agreement that we put forward to the House and the Senate. I'm really uncomfortable making amendments at this point after all the negotiations that House and Senate went through for this. I was hoping not to have amendments other than those just absolutely for errors. And I don't know whether to ask you to withdraw your amendment or whether I would just ask people to vote against it and let us proceed as we did. Yeah. Representative Paymer.
I would echo what Chair Higgins has said. I mean, put a lot of work into this bill. We didn't, as we said before, we didn't realize that we were going to get this low target or we wouldn't be in this situation. It's my hope that as the bill moves forward, passes, that the governor and the respective leadership of both of our bodies will find the resources that should be in this public safety finance bill. If you were to make a motion like this, I suppose I could make another motion and take money from another line item to go into the OJP programs, and we could be here all night trying to prepare the bill. It's certainly not my intent to have those staff reductions at the Department of Corrections, and I believe that there's a fix to this. Toward our institutions, our prisons, Deputy Commissioner Benson knows I've been out there. He knows how concerned I am about staff safety. I'm not personally going to let that happen if I have any say in it. And I just don't know that this is the right way to adjust this budget. And I would respectfully ask that you withdraw it. We have to open this bill up at some point. I will do everything that I can to open it up to ensure that we don't have that kind of layoff at the Department of Corrections.
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, my motion isn't intended to disparage the programs in the Office of Justice or the way you've handled and tried to structure this bill. I think Senator Higgins said that you were dealt a bad hand, you know, $6 million under, the target was $6 million under the governor's rec. Had we had that $6 million, I wouldn't have to make the motion. But, perhaps, and, you know, in the past 4 or 5 years that I've served on this conference committee, it's always been one of the first to settle. It's always been not terribly controversial with the governor, although maybe a couple of other things, but it's always been unanimous. I'm going to have a hard time. I may have to withhold my vote if we're underfunding corrections by that much. So that's why I feel compelled to make the motion. The result may be inevitable, but I think I got to make a record that so that I can just have a just reason for voting for or against the bill. I think when it comes to priorities, that is one of the top three or four priorities in this bill. And I'm not sure what the mechanism, you know, maybe there is a mechanism that we can pick up that extra $6 to $8 million later on. I don't know what it is. That's why I think I have to make the motion.
Okay. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Paymar. I do really appreciate all the amount of work that both of you have put into this, along with the staff. But I would concur with Senator Neville that I too am very troubled with the funding that has been dealt to the Department of Corrections, and I must say a little mystified at the questions and the. Seems like there's accusations towards them. I have to concur with Senator Neville as far as they have to live with what's dealt with them, and they've had some tremendous increases in the department as far as just incarceration levels. So just for the record, I would appreciate you listening to our concerns about this. I too am very troubled about giving a positive vote on this bill because of Department of Corrections and because of, as I said, with the drug courts and several other things that I think perhaps have been more geared towards the metro. And I understand all about the crime rate and all that in the metro, but there is a lot of one-time appropriations in this bill that seem to be geared towards just the metro or the seven-county metro. And I've been searching high and low for things for Greater Minnesota, and it's they're very slim. So I do appreciate your work, though, on this, and I think in the end we will have a very good bill, but would appreciate a vote on this amendment also.
Recess for 5 minutes, please. I'd like to talk to the Senate members in the back.
But I do want to reflect my disappointment. Well, first of all, my appreciation that you got 7 new judgeships out of that, but my disappointment that the 3rd District is getting none. I would love it for Ms. Dosal to come up to the table and say she'd be willing to shift one from the 1st District to the 3rd.
What do you say, Ms. Dosal?
Anecdotally, I mean, I know she's going to say that the weighted caseload study says this is what we have to do, but three new judgeships for the 1st District, and more than half of my district is in the 1st Judicial District. I represent Le Sueur, Sibley, and Southern Scott County. So that more than half my district is getting 3 new judgeships. I don't believe they need 3. I think the 3rd District needs one of those 3. But unless Ms. Dosal says that she would support that, I won't make a motion.
Ms. Dosal.
Mr. Chair and Senator Neville, we have for 25 years stuck with this weighted caseload, and I do think I provided information to the conferees about the caseload increases in all of the districts, and specifically in the 1st and the 3rd. And the caseload increases are phenomenal in the 1st District, and they have the fastest growing counties in the country. And we're just seeing those kinds of increases. So the position of the judiciary is to follow the weighted caseload recommendation.
Madam Chair, I knew she was going to say that. I knew that. But I also know that in my district, also in my county, the same number of judges we had 30 years ago are handling triple the caseload. And I'll bet you that's not true in the 1st District. Or if it is, they've got an efficiency of volume that make things a little bit different. So anecdotally, I don't agree with the weighted caseload study. Representative Liebling, you should be fighting for that judge in Olmsted, in Rochester.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, that's what I was going to do, Senator Neville. So I also want to join in that and expressing my disappointment, not only that there isn't a judge designated for the 3rd Judicial District, but also even that in the bill that we're specifying where the judges are going, because I think Ms. Dosal said she gave us information. Well, I asked for information that she didn't provide us. And I wonder if, having made a mistake once, whether they'll crunch the numbers again and come up with something different. So that's where my disappointment lies. I think that we should be actually leaving some flexibility there so that they can change their minds at a later point. So that's my 2 cents worth on that.
Okay. Senator Foley, you're going to weigh in on the judges in Rochester. And
thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Dosal, I'd like to... No, I thought you told me that the 10th district was entitled to 3 judges, but I don't notice that in there.
Mr. Sal?
Mr. Chair, Senator Foley, then the judgeships that are in this bill are the revised weighted caseload numbers, and so it is 2 judgeships for the 10th district.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Paymont.
Sure. For the record, since our table is not running at the time, but I just wanted to state that for the record, that on a voice vote, that the Neville Amendment failed.
Okay.
And now, Madam Chair, I would like to move the spreadsheet.
All right. We take our final votes in 2 votes, members. The first will be on the spreadsheet, and the second will be on the bill as amended, on that page 74, whatever it was. Senator Neville.
I do have one other thing to bring up on the theft thresholds. You mentioned that there was one change to deal with checks. I'm trying to figure out what sense does it make. That was my bill, and we increased the theft thresholds by the rate of inflation since 1993. What sense does it make to keep the theft threshold lower for checks, but not for anything else.
Madam Chair?
Representative Pima.
It probably doesn't make a whole lot of sense, except that that was the House position, and
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Neville, it actually was in our bill, and there was a House floor vote to remove checks from the bill specifically, while the other provisions were not in the bill previously. And so it was definitely a House position in that the checks came out of the bill on the floor.
Yeah. Representative Hillstrom, were you hearing from retailers or who?
Representative Simpson.
Representative Mullery?
Madam Chair, Representative Simpson, Chair Grant, strongly in both tax committee.
Okay. Representative Hillstrom?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, no. I actually defended keeping the checks provision in the bill, but it was not the will of the body.
Okay. Senator Neville.
Madam Chair, it was the unanimous position of the Senate to have the same theft thresholds for all theft crimes. And I strongly defended that position. And I know that the business community doesn't like that for checks, but hardly anybody goes to prison for a $600 check now. You recognize that by reason of the fiscal note only changing $40,000. They're still going to be prosecuted as crimes. And what difference does it make if you steal a $600 TV set? Or write a $600 bad check. The theft and the consequence is the same. And I think we have a duty to maintain the integrity of the theft laws. And it's the dollar amount that creates, whether it's a felony or a gross misdemeanor, it should be the same for all of them. And the Senate has an equally strong position. Yours was changed by floor amendment. Ours was not. Ours was maintained throughout the whole process. So I'd like to move that we reinstate the Senate position and have the same theft thresholds across the board for the integrity of the statute.
Senator Foley?
Madam Chair, I would support that. I think that that's a reasonable one.
Members, remember what I said about how I wanted to fix errors, but not much else?
Madam Chair, I would know we would pick up $43,000 that could buy one more security guard.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am a co-author of the bill in the House, and I would urge members to vote no. I think the message was clear from the House that this was their position, and even though I strongly argued against it on the floor, I think that the House did speak, and I would encourage members of the House at least to vote no.
Well, Madam Chair, from a procedural point of view, it's not in the bill yet, is it? Do I have to move to take it out?
No, I guess. Counsel, would somebody tell me? It's 11:30 at night. My brain just kind of quit a minute ago.
Actually, I take that back because I guess we have to vote on one or the other. So.
It's in the bill that's before us.
It's before us. I won't raise an issue on that. I'll just appeal to the House members, especially to my co-author here, to reconsider your position. I know that there'll be some business groups upset. I've gotten some emails, too, but to me, the integrity and the consistency of the statute is more important. That should be our first duty.
Okay. Any other discussion?
Not tonight, please. He doesn't want it.
On the Senator Neville motion, all in favor, please say aye.
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 All opposed, say no.
No.
I have a division on that. I can't tell.
All except in favor, please say, please raise your hand. All opposed, raise your hand. The amendment is not adopted. So everybody knows it needs three votes on both sides, and there were not three votes on both sides. Okay. On Representative Paymar's motion to accept the, or adopt, the spreadsheet. What's the right word?
Adopt.
Adopt. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
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 Adopted. Representative Paymar.
Madam Chair, I would move the DE
2 amendment.
As amended.
As amended.
On that motion, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Adopted. Thank you very much. Thank you, everyone. And members will be looking for you for signing the conference committee report in the morning. We are adjourned.